You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. School teacher Olivia Dare Christian was murdered in her Hampton, Virginia apartment in 1981. Her killer left few clues and the murder went unsolved. 3 decades later, in 2011, next-generation detective Randy Mayer reopened Olivia's dusty cold case file and began unraveling the mystery. Mayer located a reluctant witness who was a teenager back in 1981. She recalled a suspicious man lurking outside Olivia's apartment the morning of the murder and provided a detailed description of the man. Detective Mayer then researched hundreds of cold cases, hunting for a person who fit the description and used a similar MO. He identified a prime suspect, a Smithfield Foods employee by then in his 60s, previously convicted of several brutal sexual assaults. Digging further, Mayer linked him to two other unsolved Hampton homicides. Was this man a serial killer? Mayer enlisted the help of FBI agent Lisa Ludovico, cuter Phil Figura. Could the team uncover enough evidence to bring Olivia's murderer to justice? Could the witness from 1981 identify him? And would a jury convict in a cold case based entirely on circumstantial evidence? The book that we're featuring this evening is Eyes of a Monster, with my special guest journalist and author, Ron Peterson, Jr. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Ron Peterson, Jr.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to be with you.
Thank you so much for this incredible story, Eyes of a Monster. Let's get right to this case and Olivia Dare Christian and the horrible crime, September 4th, 1981, in Hampton, Virginia. Tell us a little bit about Olivia Dare Christian and what was happening that Friday before Labor Day.
Thanks, Dan. And yes, as you described in your introduction, she was a 32-year-old school teacher in the town of Hampton, Virginia. Hampton's in the southeastern corner of Virginia, the area known as Hampton Roads, kind of a waterfront town. And it was the Friday before Labor Day weekend, and she was getting ready to go into school for training and to get ready for the students to come to school the following Tuesday. And she was killed that morning at 7:30 a.m. And in a lot of murder cases, you know, the time of death is not for sure. But in this case, the murder weapon was her bedroom alarm clock. Her attacker had used it first to strike her in the head, knocked her unconscious, and then she was strangled with the cord of the alarm clock. And as an analog alarm clock, it showed the time of death, which was 7:30 a.m. And that was really one of few clues that the original investigators in 1981 had to work with.
Right. How was it that she was found and by who, and then, again, how do police proceed?
Well, she did not show up for work that day, and one of her coworkers had checked with the principal, realized she didn't call in, and it wasn't until later that afternoon that a phone call was made to her parents, who lived in a neighborhood nearby. Her father went and checked on her, and it was late that afternoon, after 5 o'clock, when he used a key that he had to enter her apartment. Immediately, he could see signs of a struggle, and as he made his way through the apartment to her bedroom, he found her there, and she was dead. The investigators came to the scene immediately. Hampton, it should be noted, is a city about an average crime rate or murder rate, you know, for cities its size, probably about one or two a month on average. So investigators were used to working homicide cases, a very good team of detectives who worked the case, among them a detective by the name of James Staveley and another one by the name of J.P. Jones, both of whom are now retired. But Hampton Police Department basically had a full court press in the investigation. You know, was a round the clock investigation, and then the days afterwards, and it continued. There was a pool of as many as five different suspects or persons of interest who were evaluated. Among them, one of the neighbors who was a woman who, you know, might have had jealousy for some reason as a motive. Olivia Christian was a single woman, lived alone. She had a boyfriend for the past year. He was vetted as a suspect. The paper boy, who was a teenager, was as well. There were at least a few mysterious men reported by neighbors in the apartment complex. And then also a man who lived nearby who was just suspicious by nature, whose name was Michael Alston, who in the days after the investigation failed a polygraph, and then a tracking dog also led to his front door. Perhaps the best lead came from a 16-year-old girl who was a neighbor of Olivia Christian, lived across the parking lot in an apartment. And the morning of the murder, about half an hour to 45 minutes before the time of death, the 16-year-old witness had observed a suspicious man drive in a distinctive vehicle. She described it to police as an aqua green four-door older sedan, the paint faded, the top a little lighter than the rest of it. And she described the man that was in the car in great detail, an African-American man, average height and build, with a mustache and a plain navy blue ball cap. According to this witness, he exited after watching the apartment complex for a while, had seen Olivia Christian that morning, and exited his vehicle, went to her apartment window, looked in the window, actually entered the lobby of her apartment corridor, and she saw him, the witness saw him with his ear toward her door, leaning in on the door, apparently listening. At first, detectives believed she was credible. She provided, under hypnosis, the 16-year-old witness provided a description to a police sketch artist and of what the man looked like, a very good composite sketch. But as the investigation unfolded, just through a series of circumstances, the police came to doubt this young girl's story. Some of the neighbors had said she was prone to drama, and for a variety of reasons that my book gets into, her account was not found to be credible, and she was actually interrogated in great detail. And finally, she was frustrated that they didn't believe her, so she said, "Hey, I just made it all up." So the investigation continued. And the case, despite a full court press by the investigators, the case went unsolved.
You say that there was reasons for the police doubting the eyewitness testimony of this Anita Purcell. But to compound that, you mentioned Michael Alston. How was it that Michael Alston was a suspect other than just suspicious nature? There were witnesses that police rather thought that they should listen to rather than Anita. Isn't that true?
Exactly. Yes. There were other residents in the apartment complex and a couple that were visiting from out of the area who gave an account of seeing a man that looked like the prime suspect, Michael Alston. And he also had a reputation as a peeping Tom and just kind of generally a nuisance he lived in a neighborhood nearby. Remarkably, he looked a lot like the composite sketch that that Anita, the 16-year-old witness, put together under hypnosis. So that fact, you know, made investigators believe that Michael Alston was the man that the witness had seen. She was interviewed again and again, came to the police station. As I said, she was put under hypnosis and was also given a lie detector test at one point. And in some ways, unfortunately, she was treated like a suspect because police, mm-hmm. Or I should say interrogated, you know, similar to the way they would interrogate a suspect, because police had reason to believe that the man she had seen was Michael Alston. However, she told them repeatedly, "The man I saw looked like Michael Alston, but it was not him." And you can imagine, you know, putting yourself in her shoes, a 16-year-old girl under this kind of pressure. Finally,
sure.
after being you know, grilled by these investigators, she said, "Hey, I made the whole thing up, you know, in large part just to remove herself from the situation."
They didn't go any further into that recantation, but to further complicate this, you write of this fascinating canine handler bringing in a dog called Harass too. Tell us a little bit about this detour for police.
Exactly. At that point in time, there was a dog tracker by the name of John Preston, who was from Pennsylvania, and he was a former Pennsylvania state trooper who worked with canines on in his job there, and he left the police force in Pennsylvania to work as a dog tracker. And he was hired by different municipalities in Virginia and throughout the country to come and help them investigate cases, in a lot of cases, murder cases. And the dog he had was a German Shepherd, not typically known for their scent work. You know, you think more of bloodhounds, but the dog, by all accounts, had remarkable skills. Now, this case, another case that I wrote a book about that happened about a year prior to this, was a no-body murder case in Radford, Virginia, the case of Gina Renee Hall. And this dog tracker, John Preston, and his dog had worked to that case, and he testified in the murder trial and essentially helped convict the killer in that case, Stephen Epperly. That was in 1980, about a year before this murder happened. So when he was able to come to Hampton to investigate this case, you know, the detectives and the police force in Hampton were really happy to have him there because of his work. And his dog, about within a week after the murder, the dog was scented on the murder weapon, on that alarm clock that I mentioned. It was brought into the victim's apartment. The dog was scented on it, and the dog followed a trail out of the apartment complex into the parking lot, down a road, across a four-lane road, and into a residential area, and walked to the front door of the house where Michael Alston lived and alerted on his front door. So that, the investigators believe, you know, was one of several bits of proof that indicated that Michael Alston was the killer. He also took a polygraph test and failed the test, or I should say the results were inconclusive and leaned toward him being, you know, lying on the polygraph. And it should be noted also, you know, in the years since, polygraph science has really come under a lot of scrutiny. This was during a time period, the early 1980s, where a lot of police departments really believed that polygraph tests with a good polygraph operator, you know, they were gospel. They believed they were very accurate. So those were two other pieces of evidence that pointed at Michael Alston as a suspect. Hence all the pressure on this young 16-year-old witness to indicate that Michael Alston was the man she saw when she repeatedly insisted, "Hey, I know Michael Alston, but that was not the man I saw. I saw a different man. He looked like him, but it was not him."
And to add even more complication, and I know this is just amazing at the beginning of this investigation, that there was a couple that was staying in the apartment complex at a friend's apartment that were originally from Baltimore. And that woman felt that Alston, again, was a good suspect. So there was that rabbit hole for police as well to investigate that claim, wasn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, the couple from Baltimore, and it was, you know, there were many things, you know, detectives afterwards felt like the investigation was cursed for many of the reasons I mentioned, but also this couple from Baltimore, the investigators in Hampton were talking with them, but each on the telephone. The woman in the couple was originally from Germany, had trouble understanding the English language, so there was some misunderstanding there. Initially, they said that they had seen Michael Alston acting suspiciously in the complex shortly after the murder, but once they were able to talk to them in person, they realized that their information was not reliable. Among other things, the night before, on a Thursday night, this couple had been out bar hopping very late, and were probably still intoxicated the next morning. You know, they finally admitted to that. So that was just one of the things that put
this supposed eyewitness account from this couple that were visiting for the weekend from Baltimore, you know, that made them realize that was not a reliable account. And one of the few reasons why their case against Michael Alston fell apart, and, you know, within months after the murder, they realized that Michael Alston was probably not a viable suspect.
Right. After the one-year anniversary of Olivia's murder, the Hampton PD went to FBI's behavioral science unit, Roy Hazelwood, and they got a profile. What was that profile that he created?
Yes, as you said, you know, Roy Hazelwood was a noted police profile. This was in the early days of profiling. I'm sorry, I didn't have that in front of me, but was trying to locate that. He felt it might have been, you know, a person younger. And hold on just a second. I'll see if I can't find that that profile that they found.
Well, it was I'll do it for you. He was 18 to 24.
Sure.
He said he was close proximity. He lived and probably walked to the scene, probably lived with his parents, likely a dropout, single, never married, likely owns a vehicle, likely unemployed, likely killed before, low IQ, loner, daydreamer, may have speech impediment. But as you write, as a result of that profile, there was no new candidates entered into this suspect pool. And another year
exactly.
went by without any developments. There is a little bit of an idea that maybe somebody, an infamous serial killer, might be involved. Henry Lee Lucas was arrested, and then people looked at Lucas. Tell us what happens in that regard, and then introduce Edgar Browning.
Sure will, yes. It was an interesting development. You know, we use the term serial killer a lot nowadays, but it was a term that really was coined in the late 70s, shortly before this murder was happened.
Right.
And it was not one that was used a lot. You know, the whole concept of the serial killer was not as prevalent as it is today. But within a few years of the murder, it was learned that there was a notorious serial killer who had actually been in Hampton Roads. His name was Henry Lee Lucas. He was originally from Southwest Virginia, was kind of a drifter who drifted around the country. And there was a Netflix series on him recently called The Confession Killer, and is just you know, really – interesting background by him, but he was linked to many, many murders. He admitted to hundreds of murders, but police realized he had maybe exaggerated his claims. But he'd been arrested in Texas, and he was interviewed in 1983, and then in 1984, Hampton police got a copy of that interview and actually had a state police officer sit down with him and talk to him to see if there was any link between him and the Olivia Christian murder and other murders that happened in the Hampton and Newport News area. And, you know, after talking with them, they realized that there was not. But for a while, that did look like a very promising lead.
Tell us about Edgar Browning from the Hampton Police Department.
Yeah, Edgar Browning was a really interesting guy and also a very, very good detective. He was one, I mentioned the other two that also worked the case, but he was one that worked the case quite a bit. But he was an Army veteran originally from Rhode Island who came to Hampton in the 70s, distinguished himself as a patrol officer, then became a detective, and was, according to the folks I interviewed, you know, was one of the best at interviewing suspects. You know, nowadays we call it an interview. In the old days, they called it an interrogation. But, you know, he was
right.
This kind of cocky guy, you know, people that kind of guy you meet him for the first time would probably rub you the wrong way. But people that worked with him and knew him, you know, really liked him and respected the kind of work he did. But he was the one that first came to realize, you know, in about 1983, 1984, that the dog tracker that we talked about, John Preston, was a fraud, and that his work in this case was probably fraudulent. So Browning was, you know, was involved throughout the early years of the investigation. He recently passed away this past year.
Mm-hmm. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, you write that this, despite everybody's hard work on this, this goes cold. This goes cold. So let's talk about Randy Meyer and what happens with his involvement in this case.
Great, and thank you. Yes, so the years go by, and it's 30 years, and this is, you know, Hampton was, by and large, the homicide detectives in Hampton or the detectives in their crimes against persons unit, you know, did an excellent job, but this was one of the few unsolved murders that that remained. So 30 years later, a next-generation detective by the name of Randy Meyer, 40 years old, kind of an overachiever in the detective squad. The kind of the protocol there is there's enough active cases for the detectives to work in the crimes against person unit there, not only homicides, but rapes, sexual assaults, armed robberies, and, you know, crimes against people. And once they're ahead on those cases, or all those cases are closed, then they may have time to work old cold cases. So they don't have a dedicated cold case unit. And that was the case with Randy Meyer. He was working on another murder, a cold case murder from the 80s, and happened just by happenstance to come across Olivia Christian's cold case file. This was in 2011, as we said, 30 years after the murder. And he brought the file home on a weekend, you know, did not have a lot to do that weekend, spent Saturday reading through the file from beginning to end, and then spent Sunday taking detailed notes and doing some analysis on it. Came back to work on Monday morning and said, you know, to his sergeant, he said, "Hey, I'd like to work this case." And his sergeant basically said, "Go for it." Over the course of the next few years, Randy Meyer pretty much became obsessed with this case. You know, again, he was very busy with his active caseload, but any spare time he had, as well as evenings and weekends, he'd spend time going through the case, interviewing some of the old neighbors, some of the old friends of Olivia Christian's, as well as some of the persons of interest. And he was able to eliminate some of the folks that were originally suspects. And the more he read through the file, the more he believed that the witness statement from the 16-year-old witness, Anita, was credible. Mm-hmm. She was telling the truth, and that she only recanted because she was pressured so much. So he managed to locate Anita. She was in her 40s. She lived in a neighboring jurisdiction. And when he asked her, you know, "Hey, just tell me, were you telling the truth? If you were lying, no problem. You know, I would just like to know." She immediately became emotional. She said, "I was telling the truth." She said, "That man's face has haunted me almost every day of my life." She said, "You know, I've had nightmares about it." And so they, you know, they have a heart-to-heart, and the conversation ends with, you know, Randy Meyer and her agreeing, you know, together we're going to try to find this guy. And then that's when his investigation really gets underway. What he did in studying this case, Detective Meyer came to realize that the attack on Olivia Christian was sexually motivated. This was a sexual predator. His motive was rape, and it was only when Olivia Christian put up such a fight, literally the fight of her life, that, you know, things tragically, they accelerated, and she was killed in this attack. You know, she, you know, literally was not going to succumb to the rape, which is just a, you know, a tragic scenario. So he then began looking. He was convinced that Olivia's killer had probably attacked other women, had most certainly attacked other women in that time frame. So he bracketed the time of the murder and looked at not only active cases, but police reports for a year prior to her murder in 81 and also a year after. He cast a wide net, was not only looking at sexual assaults, but incidents of stalking, peeping Tom, indecent exposure, you know, any crimes of dominance or power over women. And as he did that, he came across a 1982 case that happened the year after Olivia Christian was killed. It was a rape in which a man was convicted, and the attacker's MO was very, very similar to that of Olivia Christian's attacker. A lot of similarities and a lot of the same stalking behavior that he realized had taken place in both incidents. He found a picture of that man who was convicted, who served his sentence, was by then in his 60s and still lived in Hampton after he'd served 15 years in prison on the rape. When he compared the picture, the composite sketch, to the man's picture at the time of the other arrest in 82, it was almost a perfect match, you know, just a dead ringer. Found a picture of the man's vehicle that he was arrested in, and sure enough, it was an aqua green older sedan with an aqua green tight top, lighter than the rest of the vehicle, exactly as the teenage witness had described it on the morning of the murder.
And who is this person? And so what is the next step for Detective Mayer?
Well, before he approached this suspect, who, as I said, by then he was in his 60s, he did a great deal of background research on him. And I'll kind of give you a quick bio of this suspect, and as well as his criminal history. His name was Reuben Edward Moore. He was an African-American man. His appearance, you know, a very very average-looking, blue-collar sort of guy. Hampton and Newport News, the two jurisdictions there, are both, you know, racially integrated, about 50-50, Caucasian and African-American. So he was a guy that would clearly blend in, you know, in the area. His appearance, you know, nothing distinctive about him, I would say. He was born in 1951 in Hertford County, North Carolina, an area about an hour's drive from Hampton Roads. He was one of 15 siblings. He was his mother's fifth child when she was 18 years old. When he was 10 years old, his mother left him to run off with the preacher in their little small rural area, a man named Henry Smallwood, to live in Newport News. Left him behind, and for 3 years he basically lived on his own under the care of his older brothers and sisters. His father was an alcoholic, you know, did not look after him, was not in the picture. And after 3 years living alone, he moved to Newport News, which borders Hampton, by the way, to live with his mother and the Reverend. And he came to be a blended family of 21 kids. So, you know, I'm no psychologist, but he was, you know, most certainly neglected. In fact, his mother's ability to reproduce was so prolific that her obituary in 1990 listed 75 grandchildren. So, you know, by all accounts, her son, Reuben, did slip through the cracks. When he came to the area at age 13, he could not read or write. He enrolled in junior high school, you know, made straight F's and dropped out at age 14, took a job in construction. He first appeared on the police blotter in 1965 at age 15 for an attack on a white female. He was convicted of that, spent a year in a juvenile reform center in Richmond, Virginia. When he returned to Newport News, he was 16 and soon became the suspect in a series of residential break-ins. And then in 1968, at age 17, he was charged in a case that local residents still remember as the light bulb case. And what happened on March 14th, 1968, he broke into a woman's apartment through a bedroom window. She was sexually assaulted, beaten with his fist during and after the attack. And the investigators discovered that the light bulb at the exterior light fixture had been unscrewed to provide darkness to cloak his entry through the window.
Right.
And this actually matched the MO in a series of rapes and break-ins over the previous year that they'd attributed to a man they'd come to call the light bulb racist. So he was charged in that case in 1968. The key evidence against him were his fingerprints on that light bulb, interestingly enough. But at trial, his attorney argued that since the landlord bought the light bulbs at a local supermarket where Reuben Moore had occasionally shopped, he could have touched the light bulb in the store. The judge threw out the evidence, and then without this key evidence, he was found not guilty. Within a year, he was charged in another rape, attacking a woman a few blocks from his house. She was beaten, left for dead, only, you know, was basically dying of her wounds and luckily was found by the milkman. In that attack, he used a knife with a 4-inch blade, and part of that knife, part of the distinctive wooden handle, was found at the crime scene. The detectives obtained a search warrant to search his apartment, and the other part of the knife was found. The wooden handle was missing. It matched up exactly, and he was charged with sexual assault and attempt or rape and attempted murder in that case. He was convicted in 1969. He was sentenced to life in prison, and from prison he appealed that conviction. And his attorney based the appeal on the fact that the affidavit for the search warrant was vague. It only asked for implements used to commit a felony. One of the things, you know, in the United States, our Fourth Amendment rights for search and seizure specify that an affidavit for a search warrant has to be specific and accurate. The appeals judges in the Virginia Supreme Court, when this case was appealed, they determined that affidavit was faulty, which made the search warrant faulty, which made the key evidence what you would call fruits of the forbidden tree. So that evidence was thrown out. The conviction was overturned, and the prosecutor, without that key evidence, could not prosecute the case. So he was essentially a free man. So, you know, just in those cases, some unbelievable luck for him. Then he was charged with another rape or sexual assault and break-in and attack in 1971. In 1972, he was the prime suspect in a murder in which charges were not brought against him. But, you know, the folks I interviewed for that, the prosecutor and the lead detective, were 100% sure that he was the killer, but just did not have the evidence to prove it. And he was sentenced for rape in 1972, served 8 years, and came out in 1980, which, as fate would have it, was about 1 year before the fatal attack on Olivia Christian.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about his release. Where did he go, and what did he do in terms of employment? Who was he living with? Tell us what happens immediately after he gets released.
Well, he's released. He's employed at that time by the Newport News Shipyard, which the largest employer in the area, employed as many as 30,000 people at their peak employment. So he had a blue-collar job there in the shipyard. And lived with family members. Was married shortly after he got out of prison. At that time.
Now, what happens with Mayer and this interview?
Well, through the course of Randy Mayer's investigation, he's, you know, 100% sure that Reuben Moore was, and the book goes into some other things that, you know, that link Reuben Moore to Olivia Christian's murder. And then there's also the two other murders, one from 1972 and then another one from 1982 that Reuben Moore is definitively linked to. Now, the best chance of a conviction is in the 1981 Olivia Christian murder. So, you know, that's the charges they're pursuing. So Detective Mayer calls him in for an interview, says he's investigating, you know, an old case. He gets a DNA sample from Reuben Moore, cheek swab, because the original forensic evidence had degraded, you know, there's no forensic avenue to pursue there. But over the course of two interviews with Reuben Moore, where he voluntarily came in for an interview, repeatedly Detective Mayer accuses him of the murder. And Moore does not confess, but he says some very interesting things. First off, he lies about many smaller aspects of the crime, you know, tells lies that can later be proven in court that he lied. And, you know, for a prosecutor prosecuting a murder case, if you can prove that the suspect has told a lot of little lies during their interview, then you can essentially prove the big lie, you know, that they're lying about committed the murder. Among the things Detective Mayer tells him, he says, there was a witness that saw you the morning of the murder, and I think you saw her too. And Reuben Moore immediately replies, oh, I didn't see nobody out there, which, you know, puts him basically at the scene. But he kind of just said it reflectively without thinking. And as the interview progresses, Reuben Moore admits, you know, and in this he's talking perhaps not specifically about this murder, but about his other assaults on women, which, you know, there were as many as a dozen, you know, different ones in that time period. He says, hey, you know, I admit I was evil as hell one time. I did things out of pure hell meanness. And these are direct quotes from him. And then he begins to plead with Mayer, you know, that because it happened so long ago and because he had served 15 years on the other charge for rape, that he basically, you know, done his penance for that. Mm-hmm. He tells him, you know, hey, I don't even have that mindset anymore. I'm trying to move past my past. I did 15 years. And then he even talks about himself in the third person in those interviews. He says, you know, Reuben wouldn't have killed nobody, was something that he said repeatedly. And then perhaps most disturbingly, he speaks of demons. He says, you know, that back in the time period when he was committing these crimes, he tells Detective Mayer, he said, I can remember being driven by demons. He says, I don't have those demons no more. And then, you know, in an effort to determine his motive, you know, it's obvious, and these cases were an anomaly in that, you know, they were attacks outside his race. And the fact is that statistically, you know, a serial rapist will attack within their race the vast majority of the time, you know, perhaps as much as 80 or 90% of the time. And this was an anomaly because, you know, there was many as like I said, six, almost, even as many as a dozen attacks, all of them on, you know, white women. So it through the course of the interview, Reuben Moore makes it clear that his motive, that what was driving him to attack these women was the racism that he had faced. And just as an aside, you know, I can say, having grown up in this area, you know, first of all, there's still racism. You know, racism is still in our society, obviously, systemic racism. But back in those days, you know, it was 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was a tough time. The area where he lived was, you know, really rundown area. And it was the fact that blacks were discriminated against. And this seems to have been his motive in that time. And Detective Mayer asks him, you know, why did you do it? Why did you attack white women? And Reuben Moore admits, he says, because, and these are his direct quotes, he says, racially, the system was dirty. Blacks have always caught the hell, and if I could get away with something, I'd do it. And then Detective Mayer asks him, you know, well, what were you like back then? He says, well, I was a macho man. I was a macho black man. He said, what made me do it? If I put candy out and told you, you can't have that candy because I'm human and I have a right to it. So, yeah, that was later presented as in court as his motive and, you know, was a, kind of a unique part of this case.
Now, you say that 2 days later, Mayer calls Anita. And so she's having some health issues, but she calls back a few weeks later. What's their conversation and what does he want Anita to do?
Well, all along through the investigation, and even when he's identified, you know, Reuben Moore as his prime suspect, who he sure committed the murder, Mayer, having worked with a lot of witnesses in felony cases, he knows how difficult it's going to be for her to identify someone after having seen them for just a few moments 30 years earlier. And in the city of Hampton and most jurisdictions in Virginia and in the United States, you know, we've all seen the old police lineups on movies or detective television shows. You know, they use a system called a photo array where someone is shown usually six photographs, where a witness is shown six photographs one by one, and they pick the person who they witnessed out of those photographs. So they're leading up to this. Anita says, you know, hey, I saw him. I've never forgotten those eyes. The title of the book, Eyes of a Monster, comes from her quote that she always remembered his eyes because he had the eyes of a monster, and she never forgot what those eyes looked like. So she's confident that she can pick this man out. Detective Mayer, on the other hand, is naturally a bit skeptical. So he meets with the prosecutor in Hampton, the Hampton Commonwealth attorney, whose name was Anton Bell, and they agree, hey, let's go ahead, have her do the photo lineup. If she picks the wrong person, we can probably explain that to a jury if it goes to trial and it won't hurt us too much. So they take a photo of Reuben Moore from the time of the Olivia Christian murder back in 1981. The photo was actually taken in 82, along with five other photographs he's picked out of other police files from that time period. And she's shown the photos one by one. She sits down with the detectives. Protocol is you use a detective who's not involved in the case, who knows nothing about it, you know, another police officer, so that they're not giving, you know, subtle clues or any type of, you know, nonverbal clues on who to pick. And sure enough, when they get to the picture, it's the fifth one. She immediately has this visceral reaction. That's him. That's the man. That's the monster. You know, that's him. And actually almost has an emotional breakdown, you know, when she sees him again. Then she's got to look at the sixth and final photo, which she does and says, okay, that's sixth one is not him. So with that, she made the positive identification. And the book gets a bit more into that, just, you know, how dramatic it was for her to pick this man out of a photo array, you know, four decades later.
Right. Now, is this enough for Detective Mayer to go to the Commonwealth attorney, the prosecutor, to find out if there's any chance to be able to prosecute this case? Or does he probe other cases like Helen Sturgis and Julia Wolf? What's his next step?
Well, he at along about that point, he meets and he's met throughout the process with the Hampton Commonwealth attorney, whose name is Anton Bell. Now, in other jurisdictions in the United States, you know, you've heard them called a district attorney or just a prosecutor, but, you know, he'd be the guy to prosecute the case if and when it goes to trial. He tells Randy Mayer, you know, it's a 30-year-old case based on eyewitness identification is, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, basically it's too iffy. We've got probable cause to indict him for murder, but if we're talking about convincing a jury of 12 people, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a very difficult thing to do. So we need more evidence. So he has Mayer work with a few of the assistant prosecutors in an attempt to build a case against Mayer. Build a case against Reuben Moore even further. Detective Mayer continues to probe these other two homicides, the 1972 murder of Helen Sturgis and the 1982 murder of Linda Sykes, and, you know, continues to investigate those and can't quite get any more evidence. And it becomes clear, you know, he's kind of banging his head against a brick wall and you know, in building a case. So Mayer has professional relationship with an FBI agent by the name of Liza Ludovico, who works out of the FBI's Norfolk office. She's just an outstanding investigator. She has some experience working in serial murder cases, and she agrees to help out with the case. And not only that, but together they enlist the help of a special prosecutor from the state attorney general's office who specializes in prosecuting cases just like this. And, you know, hard to prosecute murder cases that are old, cold cases. And his name is Phil Figura. So the three of them together become a team and continue to investigate Reuben Moore. Among other things, Phil Figura goes through the video recordings of the interviews. You know, there's a few hours of interviews with Reuben Moore and realizes that he said enough things to not admit his guilt, but certainly to imply his guilt, you know, enough things that could probably convince a jury of that. they go before the grand jury in Hampton, and he is indicted. The suspect, Reuben Moore, is indicted for first-degree murder. He's arrested, brought in, and they, you know, they realize before he lawyers up, they're going to have one more opportunity to question him, you know, or again, you know, we, in the old days, we used the term interrogate. Now it's, you know, interview. So this time Liza Ludovico does the interview, and, you know, it's a long, gosh, a 5 or 6 hour interview with him at an FBI office, and a lengthy interview in which, he, again, he does not admit to the murder, but he says things that will later be used against him in court testimony.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Let's go back to Liza Ludovico and the strategy she employs when she goes to finally speak to him. This is a very dramatic part of the book. All of these interviews with him are fascinating, but this is a especially fascinating interview. Tell us a little bit more about how she approaches this interview completely.
Well, first of all, Dave, in the months leading up to his arrest, Special Agent Ludovico and Detective Mayer have continued to do more and more research into Reuben Moore's criminal past. You know, essentially, they know more about him than he knows about himself. They've even gone to the schools he went to, gotten school records, interviewed his family members. They interviewed his ex-wife and the wife who he was currently married to at the time of his arrest. So they've got a lot of information, and they've got a conference room at the FBI office, which is a satellite office in Newport News, where the four walls in this room are literally covered with everything, crime scene photos from the three murders, pictures of all the houses where he sexually assaulted women, pictures of the prisons he was incarcerated at. You know, the walls are literally covered. There's strings connecting maps of, you know, the victim's house to the house he was living at the time. So it's almost like this, you know, like, as I say in the book, it's like, you know, this is your life, Reuben Moore. It's, you know, almost like an intervention where they sit down with him, or where Liza Ludovico, the agent, sits down with him, you know, to interview him. So they make it clear that, you know, they know everything he has done, his entire criminal past. And part of her strategy, you know, she's come to realize that in the years since Reuben Moore got out of prison, he's apparently, and I say apparently because it, you know, may not be the case, become very religious and, you know, uses that as you know, part of his, actually part of his defense. So a lot of the interview was kind of a theological discussion about his need to, you know, the biblical need for him to come clean, confess his sins, and essentially, you know, clean himself. And that if he is truly a Christian man, he'd admit to what he did. And if he can do that, you know, she can ask for the more, you know, if he confesses to the murder, there could be some more favorable terms for him than if a jury finds him guilty. But, you know, after this long interview, unfortunately, he, you know, he does not confess to the crime.
Right. In part of the research for Mayer, he had found out that previous crimes, the star witness for the defense in defense of this man was Gloria Moore Daniels. Just as you write, tell us a little bit about her participation in enabling him over the years.
Yeah, what Detective Mayer came to learn from studying the trial transcripts, and these were transcripts I actually went back and, you know, and located in my research for the book also, but in three of his trials, and these weren't murder trials, you know, these were trials for the rapes and the sexual assaults. In each of them, one of his sisters, apparently who he was pretty close to, had testified as an alibi witness for him each time. And the, you know, it was clear that the alibis she was providing were false. And, you know, the fortunate thing was in each of these cases, he was convicted in each of them and served a prison term, you know, for each one. The jury did also did not believe her, you know, her alibi, that she actually took the stand and in sworn testimony, you know, presented an alibi to the jury for him at the, you know, the time and date of the attacks. In one instance, she said, you know, he lived with her at the time, and she said, you know, no, he couldn't have done this because, you know, my husband and I were watching television in the living room, and he was in his bedroom the entire time. So there's no way, you know, he could have left to do this. And, you know, it was obvious, I think, for anyone who reads the transcript and reads the other evidence against him that this was a false alibi. So in order to, you know, the fear is that if he's in this current case in 2011 to 2018, if he's charged with this case, that his sister will again provide an alibi for him. So along with an FBI agent, Detective Mayer traveled to Richmond in preparation for this to actually sit down with his sister to interview her and more or less in a subtle way to make it clear that, you know, he knew that she had testified on Reuben's behalf in the past and kind of get on record that, you know, what she knew about it this time and whether or not she had an alibi for him this time, which it turned out she did not.
Explain the phone call when he's in prison with his sister, and what's the content in relation to Olivia Christian?
Well, during the interview, during one of Randy Mayer's interviews of Reuben Moore, he made the comment. He said repeatedly, he said, "Oh, you know, I've never been to that apartment complex. I don't even know where it is," and, you know, and insisted on that. So then when he was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, he was in Hampton Roads Regional Jail. And the thing about telephones and, you know, the telephone communication system in any of Virginia's prisons are those conversations are recorded. The only ones that are not recorded are privileged conversations with an attorney that are protected under attorney-client privilege. All other phone conversations in prison are recorded. So there was a recording made of Reuben Moore calling his sister, Gloria, and for the first part of the conversation, you know, it's just general conversation, how's the family doing, how's this and that. Then it gets more specific, and she asks him about his upcoming trial, about the charges against him, and she happens to ask him, you know, well, have you ever been to those apartments before? And he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the book and the trial transcript had the exact words. He said, "Yeah, I've been there before. I used to do my laundry there." And he provides a description of the apartments. So this recording is you know, the prosecutor Phil Figura in his routine due diligence gets a copy of this recording. And it's presented in eventually presented in court in his murder trial.
Right. Let's talk about this trial and who are the main witnesses at this that really impact this case.
Right. Well, remember we said the investigation, Randy Mayer basically reopens the case in 2011. Then it's late 2012, 2013 when he finally identifies Reuben Moore as a suspect, and
right.
Then you know more years go by. So it's not until 2015 that Reuben Moore is arrested, and then in the case there's a series of continuances. First he hires his own attorney, and then he gets two court-appointed lawyers to represent him. So the case is postponed a bit before that. There's a few postponements actually by the prosecution, and you know, in Virginia and in the United States, there's the provision, constitutional provision for a speedy trial. His attorneys waive his right to a speedy trial, so the case finally goes to court in 2018, and he's represented by two very, very good attorneys, defense attorneys that are appointed by the court. Of course, Phil Figueroa, who we mentioned, is prosecuting this case. And it's a really unique case, and it gets a lot of media attention because, you know, the sensational nature of it. But it's a murder case from you know, 4 decades ago. And the witnesses, you know, there's a great deal of strategy in a trial, and the book gets into that about the witnesses that are presented. The first witness is one of Olivia's old friends and teachers who she taught with, who's actually the one who made the phone call to her parents. Olivia's old boyfriend is presented as a witness, you know, to talk about Olivia as a person. And also because the prosecution knows that the defense is probably going to mention his name as a possible suspect, which, you know,
right,
which he most clearly was not. One of the old detectives is brought in from 1981, James Staveley, who's by then in his late 60s. He goes through the crime scene photos and, you know, and talks about that. And then, of course, the star witness in this trial and what makes it such a unique trial is when Anita Purcell, who's now in her 40s, who was 16 years old at the time of the murder, but she testifies and the jury's presented with the information of her picking out Reuben Moore in the lineup. Very dramatic moment when she actually points him out in, you know, in the courtroom as the man she saw that morning back then. Randy Mayer also provides his testimony. And then one of the last witnesses is Liza Ludovico, who the FBI agent who talks about her interview of Reuben Moore and, you know, shares her interpretation of that conversation.
There isn't too much to the defense case. Now, what's their theory of this, and how do they proceed?
Yeah, there's really not. Reuben Moore is represented by two attorneys. One's name was Bob Harris, and the other was Stephen Smith. Both very capable attorneys. Stephen Smith, in particular, has done a great deal of criminal defense in a lot of high-profile murder cases. So, you know, this was most clearly not their first rodeo. One of the witnesses they call is Detective Staveley, the original investigator. They call him back to the stand, and you know, to try to ping his testimony. Don't have much success in that, and. Then also, you know, there's the big moment on cross-examination. They had the opportunity to cross-examine Anita Purcell, the 16-year-old witness from 81, and tried their best, you know, to ding her testimony, but she did just an excellent job of you know, keeping her composure and just confidently telling what she saw. So that's kind of their defense in a nutshell. They, you know, and the book has several excerpts from both their opening statements at the beginning of the trial and the closing statements. And, you know, in large part, they go with kind of the some other guy did it defense. You know, they talk about all the other suspects who were there and just how the passage of time, you know, that it was a rush to judgment if the jury should find him guilty. And that also, you know, the big argument, if you're on Reuben Moore's side, is, you know, how could someone who saw a person, who saw the suspect for just a few moments, you know, how can you remember what they looked like 4 decades later, 36 years later, you know, how could you do that? And that's essentially, you know, the question that the jury has to rely on. Now, it's interesting to note that I've talked a lot about Reuben Moore's criminal past. But one big challenge the prosecution had is they could not introduce his criminal history. They could not talk about
right.
that one bit. And if they brought it up, it would be a mistrial. So they were handicapped in that. So they had to just rely on, one, Anita's testimony, and two, the other key evidence, of course, was the statements that Reuben Moore made that were not admissions of guilt, but were certainly, you know, guilty-ish.
Yes. You write that there was one particular dramatic scene where one of the exhibits is very close to the jury members and has an impact on them?
Yes, early in the trial, as Detective Stabley is testifying, you know, and they're introducing the jury to, you know, the facts of the murder, the crime scene photos, and introduced into evidence is the alarm clock that I mentioned, you know, from the apartment, which had been in the evidence room in the Hampton Police Department, you know, for the last four decades, and is probably still there, by the way. But so when it was introduced by the prosecutor, there was sort of a little shelf in front of the jury box. So, you know, he took it out of the plastic bag it was in and set that clock, you know, right in front of the jury. Some jurors only a few feet from it. And several people that were in the courtroom, you know, talked about how the jurors in that front row, you know, just how squeamish they were, you know, to be that close to it. And that was probably when it hit them, you know, wow, this was the murder weapon used to actually, you know, to kill Olivia Christian back in 1981. And then when the jury deliberated, you know, that evidence was brought into the jury room along with the crime scene photos and, you know, was there on a table in the jury room. So I guess a lot of murder cases are that way where the murder weapon, the jury is actually in close proximity to it.
You talk about the verdict and the jury, or the judge and the jury, I believe, have an option rather than the first-degree murder that he is charged with. What is the verdict, and what is Reuben Moore's reaction, visible reaction?
Well, when the jury goes to deliberate, they've got three choices. Reuben Moore was charged with first-degree murder, but they've got the option of returning a verdict for first-degree murder, for second-degree murder, or, of course, a not guilty verdict. And, you know, as with any jury trial in the United States, if any one of the 12 jurors has, you know, any reasonable doubt, then their obligation is to vote, you know, to vote not guilty. So the sentencing, and I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me. I'm just looking for that. So the sentencing obviously would vary a great deal between second degree and first degree murder. The hope of the prosecution obviously was that they would arrive at a guilty verdict on first degree murder. For the book, I interviewed two of the jurors that I spoke to. Their names, you know, were on the public record in the case file, and they went and began their deliberations, and a formal vote wasn't taken, but they kind of went around the table, and two of them expressed that you know, they might have a hard time voting guilty, that they still had a reasonable doubt. At that point, they went through the evidence, you know, item by item, you know, and just went over it a little closer. According to the jury foreman, you know, there really wasn't any attempt on anyone in the jury to persuade other jurors. But when a vote was finally taken, you know, it was a unanimous decision, and he was found guilty of second-degree murder. The jury recommended a 40-year sentence, and in Virginia, the judge has the option of either officially pronouncing that sentence that the jury recommends, or with if there's extenuating circumstances, he can do either a more severe or more lenient sentence. And right. the judge went along with the jury, as most judges in Virginia typically do, and sentenced Reuben Moore to 40 years in prison.
Yeah. What was his visible reaction?
His reaction, you know, according to people that were in the courtroom, was nothing. He had no expression, no expression at all. And, you know, that seems to be the kind of person he was, you know, as a sociopath or psychopath.
Anita Purcell was crucial to this entire case, to this story, and to this trial. At one point, she did not want, with Detective Mayer's influence, she changed her mind a couple times. She didn't want to participate for various reasons. But then Olivia's brother sent her a letter. At the end of this trial, she had something that Thomas had sent in that letter, along with him trying to convince her to participate in the investigation and testify. What was that? What was Anita? What did she have with her that day of Olivia's?
Yeah, that was one of the great stories that came out of this. When Detective Mayer first met with Anita, you know, her initial reaction was, you know, I'll help you, you know, together we'll find him. And then, understandably, she got cold feet. You know, she thought about everything she went through back when she was 16, how she tried to help, but, you know, it kind of blew up in her face. And, you know, just how emotionally how tough that was and how it had affected her whole life. So she told Detective Mayer, you know, hey, you know, I just can't go through all this again. You have no idea what I went through back then. You know, I'm sorry. So Detective Mayer goes to Olivia Christian's brother, his name is Thomas Christian. He's Olivia's only surviving relative, her brother. Still lives in the parents' old house. It happens that he has Parkinson's disease, and he's in the late stages under the care of a full-time nurse. And Olivia's brother, Thomas, writes a letter to Anita, says, hey, you know, I understand what you went through back then, but if you could find it in your heart to help out with the investigation, you know, we'd appreciate it. He says, both my parents died without knowing, you know, who killed Olivia, and I've got a terminal condition, and I'm going to die without knowing. You know, if you could please find it in your heart to help, please let us know. He writes this letter, and he puts it in an envelope, and he also puts an item in that envelope with the letter, hands it to Detective Mayer. Detective Mayer, you know, he's seen the letter, but he has no idea what the item she gave him was. So then Detective Mayer, and again, this is in the early stages of the investigation, gives the letter to Anita. Anita reads the letter, does more soul searching, and, you know, that's the point when she agrees to help out and cooperate with, you know, with finding the suspect. So then you fast forward 7 years, and during the trial, during her testimony, Anita had something in her hands. She, you know, she was clutching something from a distance. You couldn't quite see what it was. So at the end of the trial, you know, when they're very emotionally, you know, celebrating, and I use the term celebrating hesitantly, you know, they're very relieved at the verdict.
Yeah.
Phil Figueroa, the prosecutor, says to Anita, the witness, he says, by the way, Anita, you know, what's that you have in your hand? I saw you had it on the witness stand. And she shows him, and it was a crucifix, a gold cross that used to belong to Olivia that her brother had given Anita.
Yeah.
So it was a really, you know, a really, really moving part of the trial, I guess, for Phil Figueroa and you know, just a really, really moving part of the story.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Ron Peterson Jr., for coming on and talking about Eyes of a Monster. For those that might want to take a look at this, you have tell us about your website, and also we haven't spoken to you since last time, Under the Trestle in 2019, your last book. Just tell us where they might be able to take a look at other work.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, this book, Eyes of a Monster, probably the best place these days is Amazon. It has been a true crime bestseller on Amazon. And again, it's Eyes of a Monster by Ron Peterson Jr. I've also written two other books over the last 3 years. The first one was about another murder case in Virginia called Under the Trestle. The second one is another true crime book called Chasing the Squirrel. And My niche, I guess, as it were, as a writer, is true crime stories from the state of Virginia. But, you know, they're right. Certainly interesting to people all over the country or all over the world. And, you know, that's typically what I write about. I've got a couple other books in the pipeline I'm writing about other crime cases in Virginia. My author website is ronpetersonjr.com. And the book's available, you know, wherever you buy books, either, you know, barnesandnoble.com. It is on the shelves in a lot of Barnes and Nobles, and also any of the online booksellers in addition to Amazon. But, yeah, thanks for asking, Dan.
Thank you so much, Ron Peterson, Jr. This has been fascinating. Eyes of a Monster. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Good night.
Good night.